Welcome to the debate. You know, when we picture modern medicine, we usually envision this setting of like ultimate precision.
Oh, absolutely. The brightly lit emergency room, the monitors.
Yeah, the steady beep of the heart monitor, the clarity of an X-ray on a screen. I mean, if you break your arm, the imaging shows this jagged white line and the doctor points right at it and says, there's the problem.
Right. It's highly localized. It's binary. You know, broken or not broken. You have the bacteria or you don't.
Exactly. And I mean, that clarity is incredibly comforting. We like our diseases to be visible, categorized, and, you know, most importantly, fixable.
Sure.
But the moment you step outside the realm of acute trauma, when you step into the world of chronic multimorbidity or autoimmune conditions, that clean mechanistic X-ray metaphor just kind of shatters. Suddenly, we're operating in a diagnostic landscape that is incredibly murky.
Murky is almost an understatement, honestly. You're looking at overlapping symptoms, compounding lifestyle factors, and interventions that, well, they seem to work perfectly on one patient and fail completely on the next.
Right. And that tension between the desire for clean mechanistic control and the messy, interconnected reality of living biological systems is the exact center of our discussion today.
It is.
We're diving deep into Dr. Bechara Saheeli's 2026 white paper, Toward a Medicine of Living Coherence.
The core question we're pulling from this material is profound. Should clinical care and health policy fundamentally transition away from our traditional model of biological control and mechanistic rescue?
And, you know, move toward a framework informed by the theoretical biologist Humberto Maturana, a framework the paper calls living coherence and condition restoration.
Exactly.
It's a sweeping, massive question because the source material doesn't ignore the triumphs of our current system. It explicitly acknowledges that modern medicine has achieved like extraordinary therapeutic power.
Yeah, it definitely gives credit where it's due. But the thesis is that we are increasingly burdened by fragmented care, an explosion of chronic disease, and endless cycles of downstream rescue. To fix this, the paper proposes an entirely new medical grammar based on autopoiesis, which is the concept of the organism as a self-producing closed system.
Right. And structural coupling, the idea that a living being and its environment constantly shape each other.
Exactly.
So I will be arguing that medicine absolutely must adopt this new grammar. Specifically, we need to integrate the 7-pattern grammar of living coherence outlined in the text. We have to stop just treating the downstream consequences of a fragmented world.
Okay.
And most critically, we must stop mistaking our diagnostic maps for the living, breathing organism itself.
And I will argue that while understanding a patient's context is undeniably important, the traditional biomedical model, you know, the model of precise, disease-specific control, is the irreplaceable engine of medical progress. Expanding the purview of medicine into this generalized condition restoration risks massive operational overreach.
Overreach.
Yes. It flirts with a vague holism that could fatally dilute our clinical effectiveness when lives are actually on the line.
Well, let's lay out our starting positions, because I think we really have to confront a deep, systemic epistemic failure in modern medicine. The paper calls this failure reification.
Reification. Right.
We have developed these brilliant, highly specific observer-mediated distinctions, things like diagnostic codes, biomarkers, risk factors. But over time, we've started mistaking those conceptual tools for the living organism itself.
We mistake the map for the territory.
Exactly. We reduce the complex patient to a broken machine part. But disease isn't a faulty cog in a car engine. As the paper beautifully defines it, disease is a stabilized loss of living coherence. So clinical care has to evolve beyond just forcing a biological variable back into range.
Towards what the text calls minimum sufficient care, right?
Minimum sufficient, condition restoring care, yes. We must ask not just how to control a symptom, but what living relationship that symptom is actually revealing.
I hear the philosophy there. I really do. But we cannot lose sight of the achievements of modern medicine explicitly categorized in the text. We are talking about antibiotics, intensive care units, modern oncology, rapid reperfusion in a stroke.
Which are all incredible, yes.
They are not epistemic failures. They are the greatest triumphs in human history. And they are built entirely on the concept of control, which this paper critiques as an outdated master metaphor, mechanistic control is precisely what drops mortality rates.
I'm not denying the mortality rates, but the text itself is honest enough to acknowledge the risks of conceptual overreach and professional burden. I argue that tasking a clinician with evaluating broad ecological, social, and relational domains actively dilutes the mechanistic precision that is absolutely required to save a life in a clinical setting.
I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective. I'm not saying diagnoses aren't vital tools, they absolutely are, but they become ontological prisons when they are reified.
Ontological prisons? Yeah, when we start believing the label is the entirety of the patient's reality. Let's ground this in the paper's example of type 2 diabetes. Labeling a patient with type 2 diabetes is a very useful distinction. It successfully reveals hyperglycemia and insulin resistance. It tells us about beta cell function.
Exactly. It's targeted.
But look at what that rigid label actively hides when it becomes the only reality the medical system sees. It hides the patient's chronic sleep loss. It hides the systemic inflammation from chronic stress, their trauma history, and it completely obscures the commercial food environment they live in.
Wait, hold on. Hiding those things isn't a failure of the diagnosis.
How is it not?
Because the diagnosis of type 2 diabetes is doing exactly what a diagnostic tool is supposed to do. Categorize a specific physiological danger so we can deploy a specific standardized treatment. I mean, a hammer doesn't fail because it doesn't measure wind speed.
But that's precisely the issue. We treat the patient as if they are a nail. Think of medical distinctions like a map. A map is absolutely vital for navigation. You'd be lost without it.
Sure.
But you cannot live inside a map. A map of a city doesn't tell you what it feels like to walk down the street in the rain. When we mistake the map for the territory, we do active harm. Let me push you on a specific, everyday example from the text.
Okay, go ahead.
How can you defend the traditional use of the term noncompliance in our hospitals when the text so clearly demonstrates that this term destroys vital clinical information?
Destroys information? That's a strong phrase.
But it does. Calling a patient noncompliant because they didn't take their medication hides whether the care plan was actually livable or affordable for them.
What?
It takes a relational or systemic failure, like, say, a drug costing $800 a month, and it reifies it into an individual moral defect on the patient's chart. It blinds the clinician.
I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that. Let me tell you why. The term noncompliance, or even the softer term non-adherence, might be administratively blunt. I'll grant you that.
Very blunt.
But let's look at the reality of the hospital floor. The paper itself admits that making sharp distinctions like identifying bacterial meningitis versus a viral headache or a myocardial infarction versus severe acid reflux are matters of immediate life and death.
Of course.
You need rigid, uncompromising maps in a crisis. If we start telling medical residents to treat diagnoses as merely provisional, observer-mediated distinctions in an acute setting, we risk introducing a dangerous philosophical hesitation into clinical pathways.
I don't think it's asking for hesitation.
When the patient is crashing, a physician cannot pause to ponder whether a diagnosis is an ontological prison. They need a rapid, standardized, mechanistic response. Precision saves lives. Provisional, holistic thinking in an emergency room costs lives.
That's an interesting point, though I would frame it differently. Because the framework of living coherence doesn't ask an ER doctor to ponder philosophy while a patient bleeds. It explicitly states that in acute crises, minimum sufficient care is rapid, mechanistic intervention.
Okay.
The framework isn't anti-emergency medicine, but let's look at what happens the day after the acute crisis, which is where the vast majority of modern medicine actually takes place and where it is currently failing.
The day after. Right.
This brings us right to the tension between what Sahali calls minimum sufficient care and your defense of absolute control. If we only treat the downstream symptoms without ever addressing the upstream attractor of the disease, we trap patients in endless rescue cycles.
Endless rescue cycles? I mean, I think that's a bit reductive. We are successfully managing chronic conditions today that 50 years ago would have been a guaranteed death sentence.
We are managing them, yes, but we are often regenerating the very conditions that caused them simultaneously. Let's unpack the text's asthma example because I think it perfectly illustrates autopoiesis.
Oh, right, the idea of the organism reacting to maintain itself.
Exactly. If a child comes in with severe asthma, treating their bronchoconstriction with corticosteroids is absolutely necessary. That's the acute control you're talking about, and it's brilliant.
Yep.
But sending that child back to a moldy, damp apartment or a traffic-polluted corridor ensures that the loss of living coherence continues. Biologically speaking, the child's airway isn't broken.
It's inflamed.
Right. It is successfully interpreting the environment as dangerous and inflaming itself to block out the toxins. If we don't shift our focus from isolated risk factors, like just looking at lung function scores on a chart, to the actual risk conditions generating the disease, we aren't truly healing.
I see what you're saying, Wet.
Imagine trying to tune a delicate acoustic guitar while someone is continuously pouring water into the sound hole. Mechanistic rescue is constantly tightening the strings to fix the pitch. Condition restoration says maybe we should stop the water pouring in.
That's a compelling argument. But have you considered that the paper's own standard for minimum sufficient care frequently demands massive systemic biological control? The text concedes this point beautifully.
In certain contexts, yes.
Think about epinephrine for anaphylaxis, or vasopressors and source control for sepsis, or profound immunosuppression for lupus nephritis. These are not gentle nudges of coherence. These are acts of overwhelming biological domination.
They are interventions, sure.
Control isn't an outdated master metaphor. It is the fundamental mechanism of survival in severe crises. Shifting the primary focus of the 15-minute clinical encounter to condition restoration, like asking a doctor to evaluate the mold in the drywall, the traffic pollution, the commercial food environment, is practically unfeasible for a physician trying to stabilize a patient's breathing.
But that is exactly why this Maturana-informed framework requires us to rethink the very boundaries of medicine itself. The physician with 15 minutes shouldn't be the only line of defense.
So who is?
This brings us to the concept of structural coupling, which is perhaps the most vital biological concept in the paper.
Ground that for me. What does structural coupling actually mean for a hospital?
Think of a tree growing on a rocky cliff. The roots shape themselves around the rock. And over time, the roots slowly crack the rock. They co-arise. You cannot understand the shape of the tree without understanding the shape of the rock.
Okay.
That is structural coupling. The living organism and its environment constantly shape each other in a shared history. A child's lungs develop in structural coupling with the air, the mold, and the housing quality.
Right.
A person's nervous system develops in structural coupling with neighborhood safety or chronic trauma. Because social systems actually participate biologically in the production of disease, our policy has to shift from merely delivering health care to health generation.
Health generation, it's a lovely phrase. But how on earth do you operationalize that without collapsing the entire medical system under its own weight?
By utilizing the 7 domains of living coherence outlined in the paper, it provides a practical framework, not just poetry. Let's look at just 2 of them. Boundary and exchange.
Okay, boundary and exchange.
Boundary is how the organism separates itself from the world. A cell membrane, the skin, but also the safety of a locked door in a home. Exchange is how it takes in what it needs. Cellular metabolism, sure, but also access to nutritious food and clean air.
I follow you.
We have to recognize that clean air, fair wages, and safe housing are not just political preferences. They are literal biological interventions. They dictate whether the organism's boundary integrity is maintained or whether its exchange of nutrients is sufficient.
I come at it from a different way. If you expand the definition of health policy to include literally everything, agriculture, urban planning, labor laws, housing, you hit exactly what the text warns about. Risk 4, policy vagueness.
It's a risk, but it's manageable.
Is it? If everyone is responsible for health, no one is accountable for it. Intersectoral governance sounds great at a conference, but in reality, it diffuses accountability to the point of total paralysis.
I wouldn't say paralysis.
And let me push back on how we actually measure success here. If we replace concrete clinical metrics like HbA1c levels for diabetes or blood pressure targets with vague system coherence measures and relational outcomes like patient trust, Don't we risk losing the hard data that drives actual medical accountability?
Well,
how do you measure the social production of coherence in a way that justifies a $1 billion health budget?
I'm not convinced by that line of reasoning because you're assuming our current hard data is actually measuring the right level of reality. The text provides a brilliant metric translation to challenge this exact assumption. Look at the readmission rate.
Okay.
Every hospital tracks the 30-day readmission rate obsessively. If a patient comes back within a month, the hospital gets financially penalized.
Because it's an objective fact, right? They either came back or they didn't.
Yes, it's an objective fact of a downstream failure. But what does a readmission rate actually reveal biologically? The paper argues it merely shows transition failure.
Okay, so what's the alternative?
Imagine if, instead of just logging a penalty, we tracked a post-discharge coherence assessment. This assessment specifically looks at housing stability, caregiver gaps, and medication affordability.
Right.
If a patient is readmitted for heart failure because they live in a food desert and can literally only access high-sodium processed food, the traditional readmission rate blames the hospital's clinical care, or it blames the patient's noncompliance.
Sure.
The coherence assessment correctly blames the provisioning environment, the exchange pattern we just talked about. It puts the accountability exactly where the biological failure occurred. Hard data is utterly useless, even dangerous, if it's pointing at the wrong cause.
Okay, but let's follow that logic to its conclusion. The coherence assessment identifies the food desert. And then what? Is the cardiologist supposed to build a grocery store? We are taking highly trained specialists who know how to manage incredibly complex physiological regulation, and we are asking them to solve systemic socioeconomic deprivation.
It's not what I'm saying.
It's a recipe for massive clinician burnout, which ironically, the paper notes, is a primary sign of system incoherence.
The cardiologist doesn't build the grocery store, no. But the health system's data coherence assessment should compel the intersectoral governance to act. That's why health policy has to be understood as the design of conditions for living.
In an ideal world, yes.
We cannot keep asking the healthcare system to manage diabetes while the commercial food environment manufactures metabolic disease at an industrial scale. We cannot ask the pediatric ward to treat asthma while urban housing policy generates airway danger.
I hear you.
That is a structural paradox. It will bankrupt our systems financially, and it will bankrupt our clinicians morally.
I don't disagree that systemic poverty and environmental degradation cause disease. Every doctor knows that. Nobody wants their patient returning to a moldy apartment.
Right.
My contention is that integrating all of this into the formal medical framework dilutes the discipline. Medicine is the practice of making physiological interventions. When we try to make it the practice of solving society, we lose our focus.
But society is biological.
Let me finish. The paper suggests we transition from predictive risk to life-serving distinction. But predictive risk using massive amounts of hard data to say, this patient has a 40% chance of a stroke in the next 5 years based on these biomarkers, is exactly how we allocate scarce resources effectively in a population.
But allocating scarce resources just to wait for the stroke is the problem. A risk score should not be a destiny, and it shouldn't be an endpoint. It should be an invitation to ask a better question.
Okay.
Let's say a predictive data model flags a patient as highly likely to be non-adherent to their heart medication. If the system just responds by sending them automated text reminders, instead of addressing the cost of the drug or their deeply held distrust of the medical system, that is incredibly shallow control.
It's automated management.
Exactly. We are mapping the risk perfectly, but we are completely ignoring the living reality of the patient.
I understand the desire for deeper relational care. I really do. But let's look at the reality of modern healthcare. We are operating at an unprecedented scale. There are millions of multimorbid patients.
Which is why the system is breaking.
Right. And we simply do not have the manpower to do a deep philosophical coherence assessment on every single person. This is why artificial intelligence and digital learning systems are our best hope for managing this overwhelming complexity.
AI is a tool, yes.
But here, the paper's deep skepticism feels almost contradictory. If we truly want to detect these broad patterns of environmental and social exposure across populations, we need massive data processing. And AI inherently requires the kind of categorization, algorithms, and reification that the paper condemns.
That is exactly where the paper offers a profound warning,
And actually, I think it's a point where you and I will find some strong convergence. The text explicitly warns against what it calls digital reification.
Right. The fear that AI, if left to its own devices, will only automate our existing biases and multiply these rigid diagnostic maps at an unimaginable speed.
Exactly. If AI is built entirely within the old grammar of mechanistic control, it will just turn patients into decontextualized risk scores faster and more efficiently than a human ever could.
Just optimizing billing and algorithms.
Yes, it will optimize billing, increase administrative burden, and completely lose the patient in the data. But both you and I and the source text agree that AI has a deeply legitimate place in the future of medicine, provided its role is strictly limited to supporting humans in making better, life-serving distinctions.
I'll completely agree with that. AI should never replace the relational work of care. Its highest value is in highlighting actionable patterns that a human might miss.
Precisely.
For example, AI can identify a specific neighborhood block with overlapping asthma triggers, or flag a dangerous polypharmacy risk across multiple specialists before a patient crashes. It has the power to process the variables, but the human clinician has to be the one to interpret the living context.
Yes. The paper sets a very clear standard for this. No classification without a pathway to care, repair, accountability, or prevention. If an AI flags a risk, the system must have a way to actually restore coherence, or the AI is just admiring the problem.
Admiring the problem. I like that. So as we wrap up this discussion, let me summarize my position. Recognizing the social, ecological, and relational contexts of patients is deeply humane, and it is a worthy ideal for society at large.
Okay.
To control. We must fiercely guard against expanding the medical purview so broadly that it collapses under its own conceptual weight. Vague holism cannot set a broken bone, it cannot reverse sepsis, and it cannot cure cancer.
And to summarize my stance, medicine must mature into the disciplined practice of making life-serving distinctions. We absolutely cannot abandon pathophysiology or the brilliance of acute rescue, but we must unite that mechanism with meaning.
Uniting mechanism with meaning.
Yes. We have to view the patient as a living, autopoietic unity, not a broken machine. Our ultimate goal must be to restore not just biological markers on a chart, but a patient's future viability and their living coherence within their world.
It's a fascinating tension. Humberto Maturana's biology offers a deeply philosophical, almost poetic lens for a highly practical, blood and gut science.
It does. It asks us to look at that X-ray from the very beginning of our conversation differently. The clean, jagged white line of a broken bone is a vital piece of information. We need it.
Definitely.
But if we only look at the bone and we ignore the domestic violence that caused the fracture or the lack of safe housing that prevents that patient from resting to heal, we aren't truly practicing medicine. We are just staring at a map, refusing to see the muddy, complex, beautiful reality of the living person standing right in front of us. There's so much more to explore in Dr. Saheli's framework, and we leave it to you, the listener, to decide. Does the future of care require sharper mechanistic control or a deeper commitment to living coherence?